The Voice America Business Channel is brought to you by Intercall, the worldwide conferencing leader. Check out easy and reliable conferencing solutions at www.intercall.com/radio.
The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Thank you for the good times. Thank you for your love. Thank you for the joy you've given me. Yeah, yeah. Thank you.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, a program designed to promote a positive work environment. Your hosts are Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. In this hour, you will be motivated to motivate, increase morale, productivity, loyalty, and reduce turnover. Learn how some companies get it while others don't. Now, here are your hosts, Roy and Max.
Welcome to Real Recognition Radio, the show that's all about building relationships, inspiring greatness, and creating a workplace where people can thrive. I'm Max Brown, along with my colleague Roy Saunderson, and we're both from the Recognition Management Institute. And Roy, as a show today, I'm excited because I've got a big smile on my face.
Uh-huh. Why is that, Max?
Well, as you know, our guest today is Sean Aker, who is a former lecturer at Harvard University and author of The Happiness Advantage, and his book has a huge smile going across the cover, and it caught my attention when it became one of these bestsellers that everyone was talking about. Sean is a winner of a dozen distinguished teaching awards at Harvard University. You know, one of those universities you might have heard of. He delivered lectures in the most popular class at Harvard, and he lectured in 42 different countries on how positive psychology can raise happiness and performance. His work has received attention in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Forbes, and Business Week. And in 2006, he served as head teaching fellow in a positive psychology class that enrolled one out of every seven Harvard undergraduates. For 7 years, Sean served as the officer of Harvard, living in Harvard Yards, studying and counseling Harvard students, and he now travels around the world giving talks on his research. When the economy collapsed, the world's largest banks actually sent Sean on a tour of banking crisis centers to restore confidence and forward progress, which we want to talk to him about today. And he's currently collaborating with Yale University on researching the link between happiness and performance. So, Sean, thank you for being on the show with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Oh, we're delighted. And maybe just to get started, could you just tell us, what is the Happiness Advantage all about? Why is it so important?
It's a great question. The Happiness Advantage is based upon a decade's worth of psychology research, which suggests that the way that we normally think about work, the way that we normally think about happiness and success, is actually broken. We oftentimes think that if we can work really hard in the present, then we'll be more successful. And if we're more successful, well, then we'll be happier. But it turns out when we did the research that, first of all, every time somebody is successful, we find that their brain just changes what success looks like. So even if you hit your sales target this quarter, you just change the sales target for the next quarter. And so success keeps getting moved. And so happiness keeps getting moved, and we actually push it over the horizon. But the research that I've been doing at Harvard and with these different companies is trying to change the entire way that we think about work and success, because it turns out that the formula works in the opposite direction. We found that if you don't wait for happiness, if you don't wait for positive leadership, if you start with that in the present, in the midst of the challenge, in the midst of your work, or while a student is at school, then your success rates rise even more dramatically. In fact, we find that your brain is able to work harder, faster, and more intelligently. So the Happiness Advantage is the idea that your brain at positive has a significant advantage over your own brain at negative or neutral, raising every single business and educational outcome at the same time.
Wow. So it is true that happiness precedes successful outcomes?
That's a great way of saying it. You know, oftentimes we just think happiness is what happens afterwards. I was just speaking to a company this morning, and they're going through all these this massive restructuring. This is a large Fortune 500 company, and they said, you know, we were trying to decide when to do a training with you on positive psychology. We were thinking we were going to do it once this crisis is over. Then we can start talking about happiness and positive leadership. But it turns out that this is exactly the right time when people should be doing it, while they're trying to achieve a higher level of success. Because happiness is, you know, in good times, is actually a luxury item. We don't need our brains to be working at their optimal level when things are going well. But when we're in the midst of crisis, when we're in the midst of challenge, happiness becomes not a luxury item, but a necessity. It actually allows our brains to overcome challenges more better. It allows them to see more possibilities of changing the present reality, and allows us to feel the life satisfaction that allows us to keep moving forward, even in the face of adversity.
But easier said than done, isn't it? That, I mean, typically when we're in adversity and trial is actually when we probably aren't thinking a lot around happiness.
You're right. As you mentioned in the intro, I started doing this research with the financial centers when the banks started to collapse during the banking crisis of 2008. And when I first went in to work with some of these companies, I thought I'd see people working as hard as they could to move forward, trying to restart that forward progress. But what I found was just the opposite. The people were so unhappy, they were so frustrated, that the teams were in dysfunction. The productivity had decreased, everyone felt stressed, and their brains were not working as well as they could have been. That's right when it's very difficult for us to be able to make some of these changes. So what I've done in the book, The Happiness Advantage, is we've been researching the 7 strategies that we've seen Harvard students and that we've seen executives and employees worldwide be able to implement that allows them to create that type of positive leadership in the present so that they can either make a habit change to create a positive habit in the midst of challenge, which will then buoy their ability to be able to overcome that challenge, or to be able to ripple out positive leadership to a team, allowing them to be able to become more engaged with tasks and more invested in the work and the goals that they've been set up with.
Maybe we could speak a little bit more about this because, I mean, I know that positive emotions then do impact, as you said, it broadens us, there's an ability to see better and to process things better. How does this broadening effect create competitive advantage? Why, it might seem even obvious, but yet there's still some resistance, it seems, for a lot of people to say, hey, this sounds too Pollyanna for me, so give me a bigger business case is maybe what you've heard before.
That's right. Well, here's a good business case for it. What we find is when your brain is positive, the front part of your brain, your prefrontal cortex, that's the part that makes good decisions and makes good financial decisions. It helps you to see ways of changing the reality around you into a better one. That's turned on to its highest levels when your brain is positive. But as soon as you're negative or become stressed or feel overwhelmed with your work, this middle part of your brain that we call the jerk, it's the amygdala, that starts to steal resources from the front part of your brain, the thinker part of your brain. So we can actually watch in a brain scan a war between the jerk part of your brain that's feeling overwhelmed and the thinker part. And what happens is you're stealing resources from the part of your brain that makes you successful. So the more you can get people to become positive in the midst of challenge, what you're doing is not making them turn a blind eye to their problems. What you're doing is allowing their brain to actually be able to overcome those problems in an even better way. The research that we do is not about ignoring problems or, as you mentioned, like the Pollyannish idea that maybe people are just putting on rose-colored glasses and, you know, that the happy people really don't know what's going on. After one of my talks on optimism at a company, I got into a cab with somebody going to the airport, and I was searching around for the seatbelt in the back of the cab because it was, like, stuck in the seat. And he didn't put on his seatbelt, which was out in the open. I was like, you don't wear seatbelts? And he said, no, I listened to your talk. I'm an optimist now. I don't need to wear a seatbelt. And I was like, no, you're not an you're an idiot. Why would you not put on? Optimism won't keep you going through the windshield. Optimism won't stop a car from hitting you. Optimists and pessimists both see problems. The difference is how they decide to view the problem, what their response is to those problems. So let's say you have a business crisis or a restructuring or just a lot of work that's on your plate. An a pessimist sees those negative things, the problems, and says these are permanent and pervasive, meaning that these aren't going to change and this affects everything. But the optimist sees those problems and says, I don't want those to happen, but I also believe that they're local. That means that they're one part of reality, and they're temporary, which means that if I can keep working on this and rally my resources, I can make a change to this problem. So what we want, in conclusion to that question, is what we want is rational optimists, not irrational optimists, like the person who wouldn't wear a seatbelt. A rational optimist and a leader at a company who takes on that type of belief is someone who doesn't put on the rose-colored glasses in the present. They actually try and see reality as clearly as possible while maintaining an optimistic belief that our behaviors matter and that social support at work is crucial to job success.
Okay, so you added two new elements here, which I think are really interesting. And that is that we've identified that social support is really, really crucial, and that that network of that things will get better based on that social network, and that those behaviors will actually increase productivity is crucial.
You're right. So let me extend the business case even further to say that if I know an employee's IQ, their intelligence, and their technical skills, as a scientist, I can only predict 25% of their long-term job successes. 75% of what causes an employee and a student to become successful are predicted not by intelligence and technical skills, but by three other factors that we often overlook, especially in the midst of challenge. Those three factors are, first, the belief that your behavior matters, which is how we define optimism. If you believe your behavior matters, you're going to keep working on projects. You're going to keep working in the midst of challenge. You're going to keep trying to better yourself. If you're a student and you believe your behavior matters, you're going to study because you think that's going to have an impact upon your long-term performance. The second predictor of that 75% of job success is social support. If your family members, friends, and coworkers, if you believe you have high social support with them and that they are positive influences on you, your success rates actually rise significantly over somebody with equal levels of intelligence but low social support. And the last one is everyone experiences stress. Students or employees all experience stress. But some people view stress as a threat, which turns off the human brain. It narrows us down to fight or flight. And some people view it as a challenge. And when you view stress as a challenge, it actually turns on the human brain to its highest level, allowing you to achieve at a higher level. So those three predictors, social support, optimism, and ability to see stress as a challenge, predict 75% of our long-term job successes.
Wow. It's fascinating when you think about it. In the final minute, how much does, before we have to take a break, how much does a leadership by fear cost an organization?
A lot. In the short term, very short term, fear increases our energy. I talked to a stock trader who, after my talk, told me that the way he motivates his team is he says if they make a single mistake, they're fired. And what that does is it motivates you in the short term for maybe 2 or 3 days. But if you try and work like that for 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years, your brain turns into fight or flight, which means you don't expand your potential. You don't actually go outside of your comfort zone to try new things. And it means your brain is constantly using up energy and resources because you're stressed. A much better way is to activate employees' brains to its highest level by creating positive leadership.
Wow. And another big reason for why this is so important. I hope when we come back, we can continue to explore some studies around why optimistic leaders get better results if there are things like that. We have to take this quick break, Sean, but I'm really grateful you're here. For Max Brown and Roy Saunderson, you're listening to Real Recognition Radio on the Voice America Business Channel with our guest today, Sean Aker. And we'll be right back. Please stay tuned.
Find out what's happening on the Voice America Talk Radio Network. Find out about new shows, featured guests, and what's up this week. Find us on Facebook by searching keyword Voice America.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Relationships are the core of great businesses. Your employees are critical to the success of your business. Rideau helps you build positive relationships with your people. Rideau helps you inspire greatness in your people. We do it through the power of recognition and rewards. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. We're committed to our clients and our people. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. I'm Roy Saunderson and Max Brown, and our guest today, Sean Aker, former lecturer at Harvard University and author of The Happiness Advantage. Sean, I'm kind of excited to hear this whole premise around the importance of being happy first rather than expecting that as the outcome. You describe seven principles in the positive psychology that fuel success and performance at work. Could you share those with us, please?
Certainly. Actually, it takes a while to go through all seven, but I'll give you an example of what type of principles we're talking about here. What we did for these seven principles is we tried to glean from the top-performing teams and the top-performing employees worldwide in terms of about why is it that some people rise so far above average in terms of their productivity levels or their sales or their energy or their resilience in the face of challenge. One of the things that we found that these individuals are doing is changing their cognitive patterns, changing the way that they actually view the world so that they can make better decisions. One of the principles that we talk about in the book is something called the Zorro Circle. The Zorro Circle is based upon an idea originally that I've been reading about in my studies of literature about how Zorro, who is this masked hero, wanted to exact revenge against an entire army and be able to fight a prince and win back this woman, but he had no discipline in his fighting. So when he found that he couldn't accomplish that, he very quickly turned to drinking in despair. His brain felt overwhelmed until a swordmaster came and made him fight within a one-foot radius circle. And Zorro did not want to do so. He said, I want to fight this army. I don't want to fight within a circle. But the swordmaster said, once you've been able to fight successfully within that sphere, that one-foot radius circle, then we'll slowly expand it out. And in doing so, by the end of it, Zorro was fighting 20 people and swinging off chandeliers. That story that we saw there actually mimics exactly what we see in the working world. What we find is oftentimes, especially around the beginning of the year, we set these lofty goals for our teams, for ourselves, these sales targets we're setting for ourselves, and we want to set auspicious goals. But what we find oftentimes is that those large goals become so large and abstract that they actually turn off the brain's ability to accomplish them. We start to feel overwhelmed. Like after one of my talks, somebody came up to me and said, well, clearly based upon this research that shows that exercise is the equivalent of taking an antidepressant, I'm going to go run a marathon. I'm going to start training for a marathon. And that person wasn't exercising at all. So I think the chances of that person being able to accomplish that are actually pretty slim. What he needs to be able to do is to narrow it down to a sphere of action that he knows he can be successful within. It's what we call the Zorro Circle. What we do is you take a large goal, but narrow it down to a small, manageable goal that you know you can accomplish, one concrete action. Once your brain has accomplished that, then you can slowly start to expand the circle out. So if you're dealing with your inbox, for example, what we do is not have you try and take care of cleaning up the entire inbox all at one time. We just draw a metaphorical line in the sand at, let's say, 2 p.m. in the middle of the day. Then every email after that you respond to, and then you slowly start working your way back. What we find by doing things like that, we find that these individuals are able to achieve it at much higher levels. Their brains don't shut off, and their brains record that victory that creates a cascade of success. So each of the other six principles follows in that pattern. We were looking at what are these habits that these leaders and these employees do that actually create long-term changes to their ability to raise their success rates.
Wow. And I'm a great fan of Zorro there, so I admired him in my childhood. So I've got that imprinted on my mind on how he does that sword fighting. So we just need to kind of expand ourselves slowly and not kind of overwhelm ourselves.
That's right. It's how video games work, if you think about it. That's why video games are so addictive to children and to adults as well, admittedly. What we find is that what video games do is they make one small task that you have to accomplish, and then you have a feedback loop that says, yes, you accomplished that, and here's some recognition for it. The easiest way to get a kid to stop playing a video game is to make them invincible or make those steps very large before they can feel like that they made some sort of accomplishment. The same thing is true for us when we get at work. Our brain needs victories and wins in order to believe that our behavior matters. That's that first pillar of the predictors of success that we mentioned before the break, is if you can increase somebody's belief that their behavior matters, you can increase their success rates in the long run. So one of the things that we suggest that leaders do, we found this in the coal mining industry originally, that if you get a manager of a team to raise his or her praise and recognition by one per day, so that's one comment that they make to one person on their team, one day for 21 days in a row at work, 21 business days, what we find is that 6 months later when we came back in and tested those teams, compared to the ones that did not have managers increasing the frequency of recognition, we found a 31% increase in the productivity of that team, which is stunning. We never expected that a piece of praise could have that much of a large impact, especially not in the coal mining industry. Mm-hmm. Across industry now, we've seen 20 to 35% swings in productivity based upon when managers make employees feel that their behavior matters. In other words, that they're recognized regularly for their accomplishments. Because what you're doing is you're teaching that person, my behavior matters.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's quite the measurable gain. And I've been curious along the way is about how do you measure the happiness component?
Well, happiness is interesting. If you think about it, happiness is just like pain. When you go into a hospital, if I broke my arm, there's no pain meter that they can hook me up to, and then they decide how much pain medication I need. They have to go based upon my subjective experience. So
right.
If I break my arm, it might feel like a 10 to me, but it might feel like a 2 to Max. And he's like, that's not that bad. So what we do is we do the same type of methodology with happiness. Happiness is something you perceive yourself. So
yes.
If you think you're happy, you actually are happy. What we do is we have you answer these questionnaires, these metrics that we come up with, and it gives us a number for you, a number which is useless unless it predicts some other things. Unless that number predicts your biochemicals that are occurring within inside your body, the number of success rates that increase for you in terms of productivity and energy, the number of friends that you have, your social support network. So what we're actually attempting to do is to triangulate happiness based upon all this different type of research of what's going on inside your body, what's going on outside of you, and your brain's perception of happiness. And in doing so, we found that these numbers are actually significantly predictive of long-term success.
Wow. I'm liking that concept as Max and I are always kind of delving deeper into recognition. You're providing us those insights on that. Now, how do we train our brain to be happier then? Where do we begin?
I think we begin at the individual level. Oftentimes when people hear this research or read my book, they're like, oh, I need to give this to somebody. Or, you know, this is interesting, but my spouse really needs to hear this. I already kind of get this. It's very easy for us to talk about what other people are not doing, but oftentimes to miss out on what gains we could have ourselves. What I suggest people do after reading the book or after hearing a training is to all they do is just to change one habit, create one positive habit for a period of 21 days in a row. research that we've been doing suggests that you can take a small habit in a period of 21 to 28 days and make that a life habit. So if you brush your teeth 21 days in a row, day 22, you won't even think about it. You just naturally do it. So we've been doing that with a couple of different things that we've been researching creates long-term effects. What we found is that if you write down three things you're grateful for every morning, it's very simple. It sounds almost too simple. But if you write down three things you're grateful for every morning for 21 days in a row, and there are three new things each day, and you're specific about them, what your brain is doing is it's scanning the world for the positive. It's using its resources to look at the positive instead of just the negative or all the tasks you have to do. And when people do this, surprisingly, and this is why we do this research, 21 days later and even 6 months later, what we find is that person's level of optimism has significantly increased. And the reason for that is in the book I go through a chapter called the Tetris Effect, which is your brain gets stuck in these patterns of scanning the world. And if you can get your brain stuck at positive, you can make long-term changes to your optimism level, which based upon the happiness advantage research means that every business and educational outcome will follow that as well. So what I suggest is people try out for 21 days in a row one of these five things, writing down three things you're grateful for every morning,
right,
or journaling for 5 minutes a day about a positive experience you had over the past 24 hours, exercising, meditating for just 2 minutes a day. That's just watching your breath go in and out and taking your hands off of your keyboard. We've been doing that at Adobe with some of their senior leaders there, and we just have them take their hands off the keyboard, watch their breath go in and out. And when they do that, it trains your brain for what we call a Tetris effect, a pattern for doing one thing at a time. So you can do multiple tasks, but your happiness levels rise and your success rates rise. So trying that out for just 2 minutes a day. The last one is my favorite one, and it's actually the one that has the greatest amount of effect, is that every time you open your inbox for the first time during the day, you write a two-sentence email praising or recognizing somebody on your team, your family, an old coach, an old teacher you have. When you do that, you raise your social support and raise your happiness level significantly, not to mention what you're doing to them.
Wow. I've been writing notes furiously here, Sean, so this is a great list of things to be cognizant of in our day-to-day work. Now, obviously, there's going to be some cynics out there who are going to feel like they don't have time to be doing all these things because they've got so many problems to deal with, and they got to produce those latest sales results, whatever. What do you say to people, say, this won't work here?
I heard a quote once about Martin Luther. I was at the Harvard Divinity School before getting into this research, and he started the Protestant Reformation. He was leading this entire movement, translating the Bible into another language, which is quite a task in and of itself. And somebody said, I heard that you meditate or pray for like 3 hours every morning. How do you do it? You're so busy. And he said, I couldn't possibly get all this work done if I wasn't taking those hours out of my day. What we're asking people to do in this research is not to take hours out of the day. We're talking about, for example, the gratitudes, which is 45 seconds out of your day.
Mm-hmm.
My real question is, if our research shows that we can have a swing of 20 to 35% increase in our productivity, or an increase of 37% in our sales, or if doctors are 19% more effective at coming up with the correct diagnoses, then is 45 seconds of investment of our time worth it? And I absolutely think it is, based upon this research, and I think we have 45 seconds. And what we find is, what I'd like people to do is try this out for 21 days in a row and be a scientist for yourself. Observe, see how your happiness levels and your success rates rise based upon this 45-second investment. And if it works, try out one of the other habits as well. And when you do this, what you should find is the time you're taking out, you reap back tenfold in terms of your productivity.
Well, you're bringing back some memories of when I was first at university, and one of the TAs told me to take half an hour and just think on the experiment as to why it worked or didn't work, and then find the research that supports your thinking on it. And it was only then that I had my breakthroughs. So I'm appreciating this kind of thoughtful perspective. When you think about those financial clients that you went to at the height of the crisis, In the final minute before this segment closes out, what was the one key message that you tried to give to those people?
I think the key message is my behavior matters. That seems to be the core part of this research, is as soon as they think that what they do matters, they continue to make positive changes. What happens to us at work and what happened to those bankers in the midst of the banking crisis is they started feeling like everything was outside of their control. Market forces, I'm not getting enough information from senior leadership, the amount of resources is drying up. And when that happens, our brains learn helplessness. We just stop acting. What we want to do and what allows people to achieve their highest levels of potential is when they start to invest in other people and when they start to believe that their behavior matters. And if you can get one of those two components happening, you can restart forward progress and raise those business outcomes very quickly.
Wow, and I think that's a nice contrast there, not only that your behavior matters, but also to invest essentially in the behavior of other people. I think that's a good combination. Sean, it looks like we're due for another break. This conversation is going way too fast, but please join us back in a few minutes on Real Recognition Radio as we continue to ask our guest, Sean Aker, more about the happiness advantage. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Roy Sonderson and Max Brown.
We're making it easier to listen to the Voice America Talk Radio Network live wherever you go on iPhone, BlackBerry, or Android. Download it from the Apple iTunes App Store, BlackBerry App World, or Android Market.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
The next generation of employees is more sophisticated about recognition. They want to make a difference to their organizations, to their environment, and to their world. Rideau offers a full suite of recognition and reward solutions tailored to meet our clients' needs strategically, technologically, and globally. Rideau's clients are Intel, RBC Financial, Boeing, and Liberty Mutual. Together, Rideau and our clients create better workplaces, better businesses, and ultimately, a better world. Become a Rideau client. Find us at rideau.com. Rideau is the proud sponsor of Real Recognition Radio. Up-to-date business and financial news. Call now and get the financial information you need. 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790.
The experts are here.
Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Sonderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Sonderson and myself, Max Brown. And, of course, our guest, Sean Aker, former lecturer at Harvard University and author of The Happiness Advantage. Sean, as you were talking just before the break there, we were talking about social support and as Roy mentioned as well, talking about how important it is to not only believe that our behaviors matter, but that we can help other people realize that their behaviors are important as well. Would you define this as a characteristic of leadership?
Not only would I describe it as a characteristic of leadership, I would characterize it as a characteristic of the people who are become the most successful. This is what we've seen in these outliers, these individuals that are way above the curve at both Harvard and at Fortune 500 companies. What we've been finding is the correlation between social support and success rates in the midst of challenge is 0.7, which if you don't have a background in statistics, that sounds really low. But that is an extraordinarily strong correlation. It's higher than the correlation between smoking and cancer. But here's the problem. What we find oftentimes is that when people get stressed at work, they do the most unintelligent thing possible. They divest themselves from the greatest predictor of their happiness and success during a time of challenge. What we find is that these individuals actually start eating lunch at their desks instead of meeting up with their coworkers. They stop talking to people in the hallways. They stop writing nice things in their email. They spend less time with their family and friends. And their justification for that is, I've got too much work on my plate. I've got too much that I have going on. I can't invest in other people. What we find is One of the principles in the book that we found was so predictive for people was something called social investment. And social investment is, it turns out in the midst of challenge, the most successful people actually increase their social investment, the investment in their social support during times of challenge. They actually try to have more social engagements at work. They don't cut the budgets for things like food breaks for their coworkers. They actually make sure that they spend time with their family and friends. Because we see people like the Harvard students I worked with, sometimes they would spend 18 hours a day in the library, and then they say, I'm getting worse grades, I'm not enjoying my work, I feel depressed, I don't feel happy here, what's going on? What's going on is they divorce themselves from the greatest predictors of success and happiness. So what we encourage people to do is not only to think about how their behavior matters at an individual level, but make sure that they're connecting up with the social support network. And in doing so, you're not only helping other people at work and at home. What you're doing is giving your brain its best chance at raising success and happiness during the time of challenge. Now, if you're busy, you don't have time to, like, go spend, you know, 4 hours a night hanging out with friends at a bar or at a party. So what we suggest is we have people just write a two-sentence email, like we mentioned before the break, praising somebody that's in their social support network. Or in the middle of work, when you're starting to feel overwhelmed, go have a five-minute conversation with a coworker. Or connect up with send a text message to a child or to a spouse, reminding them about something good that was going on or something about their day. When people do that, their brain actually gains back energy and starts, the thinker part of the brain starts to work again.
So I have a couple of things rolling through my head here, and I would love to get your opinion on where this is at. Because okay. It seems to me like the benefits of being other-focused, as you just suggested here, you know, praising someone else, thinking outside yourself, it's a message that I adore. I love this message, and it's something that I share a lot with people. But I want to clarify a little bit around this, because for me, great leadership is about being other-focused, yet a lot of leaders find themselves stuck in an ego trap. In fact, we can all have, you know, some sort of ego that kind of prevents us from thinking about others. So what do people do that get really stuck in an ego trap so high it's all about them, yet they assert themselves or they say that they're happy, but it just doesn't seem that way. And in fact, people don't really enjoy being around them either. I mean, what do you suggest for people who feel stuck in a situation where they work for someone who it's all about them?
Well, there's a couple questions in there, and they're all important.
There's a lot of it, actually.
One of the things that we found very quickly is that charisma, I had a misconception of charisma and leadership before I got into this research. I thought it was, you could walk into a room and everyone, like, turns and cares about you or, like, thinks you're the most important person that just is in that room at that moment. Turns out that that's not charisma, that's presence, where you walk into a room and everyone notices you and you become very important. Charisma is actually where you make every person in that room feel as if they're the most important person in the room. It's outward focus, and that's what actually makes people bond to these leaders long term. So what we find is that oftentimes leaders confuse that, so they try and become as independent as possible, as egocentric as you were mentioning. But independence is a much weaker model than interdependence. We found that the most successful leaders, the ones that create the greatest impact upon their companies, are the ones that actually activate other people within the social support networks of their company, that they're outward focused, and it actually ends up increasing your levels of happiness as well. It turns out that the greatest buffer against depression is getting yourself out of the mindset of, am I happy or am I not happy right now? Am I depressed or am I not depressed? But going and doing an altruistic act, like helping somebody out that needed help or going to work in a soup kitchen. And very quickly, what happens is your brain is focused on, am I making an effect upon another person? When that occurs, not only does it change the type of leader you are, where you start becoming outward focused and activating the people on your team, but it actually increases at the same time the belief that your behavior matters, because you can see what you're doing rippling out throughout the social support network. So very quickly you realize you gain power by being interdependent instead of independent.
Right, which might seem counterintuitive at first.
Absolutely. I think a lot of this research is counterintuitive. I think even the idea of that happiness isn't just going to come once you get promoted to a certain rank within a company or that once you get that bonus or once you hit that sales target. I think what we need to do is we need to be counterintuitive about the way that we think about leadership within our companies and about business, because what we're finding is that it's these counterintuitive ideas that create long-term impacts, that the best way to be able to achieve your sales target is to raise your levels of optimism and happiness while you're trying to get that sales target. And if you're waiting to be happy until afterwards, your brain is using less of its potential the entire way.
Mm-hmm. So you're basically running with a limited belief and a limited ability to actually accomplish the goals you have set out to achieve.
Yes, everyone has a range of potential, and when you're positive, you're at the upper end of that range.
Mm-hmm. And heaven knows, then I need to be as happy as possible because my range could be limited.
That's right.
Hey, I'm curious, what other studies stood out or surprised you either while you were writing the book or since you've written the book? Is there anything else that has surprised you since or perhaps during?
One of the things that I think is most surprising about this research is how much we're impacting other people all the time. I love the idea of the discovery of these mirror neurons in the brain, a mirror like you look at in the morning, and a neuron, a small part of the brain. What we found is that if you're around somebody who's smiling or yawning, it turns out your brain, even if you're not smiling or yawning, starts to light up and show activation in these mirror neurons, which cause you to feel like you're smiling or that you're yawning. Mm-hmm. And so very quickly, it becomes contagious. These mirror neurons that we found inside the human brain over the past decade mean that we're actually hardwired for empathy, which means when we see somebody else experience something, it makes us start to feel it as well. It's why positivity and negativity are contagious inside these organizations. But this is where it gets difficult, because you can be an extraordinarily optimistic leader or an employee at a company, but if you're surrounded by people that are toxic or that are stressed about changes to the economic landscape or restructuring that's occurring within inside the company, very quickly your brain can start to believe that you're as negative and stressed as they are as well, and it spreads. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you have these mirror neurons also gives you great power. Because it turns out that if you can make one positive change to your habits or to your leadership style or to your mindset, it turns out because we're all wirelessly connected through this mirror neuron network, it actually means that that small change that you made will ripple out to the people around you, your coworkers, your family members. It turns out even strangers waiting for a plane with you, which is how powerful this information is. So it makes us go back to the drawing board of saying, okay, what positive change can I make in my life that will actually impact this negative boss that I have, or impact mm-hmm. this client who seems to be focused on all the stressful or the negative parts of life, or even upon a spouse? And in doing so, you're actually rippling positive change throughout an organization.
So that comes back to the original question I had, where I kind of had a convoluted question, rather, but I concluded by saying, you know, how do you deal with a toxic boss, maybe an egocentric boss? And you're suggesting, hey, the main thing is to reciprocate or at least to spread goodwill yourself, and that will, in fact, impact that person in some way or another.
Yeah, there are social scripts that define us all the time, scripts that we live by. One of the very first things we did at Harvard in the social psychology class is send students out into Harvard Square in pairs, and one of them had to break a social rule. What that means is they'd have to stand in an elevator, and one of them would slowly turn around and face the back part of the elevator, or just lie down in an elevator, or they'd go into Starbucks and barter for a cup of coffee or ask for free samples of things you can't get samples of, or one of the soccer guys asked everyone on his team if they would soap up his back for him because he was so tired after practice. All these things that we know not to do, but we've never been told that. We have these social scripts that kind of define how we should live out our lives. The interesting part is that when people start to make positive changes, you actually have the ability to change the social script you find yourself in, even if you're not the boss, even if you're not the highest-ranking person within the room. Everyone knows, well, it's very easy to see. If people are gossiping about somebody in a negative way, and you just say something like, actually, I really like that person, you'll see the conversation in the script kind of stop as people realize, wait, the script is actually changing now, and people try and reorient towards that. So what we find is you have less control over your toxic boss if you have one. You have less control over those negative people than you have over yourself. But the research shows that if you can increase your levels of optimism, positivity, not only can you become more resilient and inoculate yourself against them, But it turns out you're actually starting to affect them as you change the social script at work from negative and stressful and let's focus on the negatives to here's somebody who's focusing upon positive change.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting. So, my goodness, it goes way too fast. But so, in a nutshell, if you were to put this in a 30-second soundbite, what do companies need to do to compete in the future? And we might have to continue the conversation afterwards too. But what would you say is the key for companies to compete?
I think step one is for companies to realize that the greatest competitive advantage in the modern economy is a positive and engaged workforce. That if you're hoping your workforce will become positive and engaged once you're successful, you're already behind the rest of the companies. That what you really need to do is invest in positive leadership, and in doing so, by raising up the levels of happiness and optimism of people on your team, you can raise every single business outcome there is. This is research aimed not just at happiness. This is research that's aimed at raising the bottom line.
Absolutely. I love it. We have to take another quick break, but when we come back, we'll come back with our final segment with Sean. For Real Recognition Radio, this is Max Brown and Roy Saunderson reminding you to keep it real.
Think you've seen everything there is to see in online television? Let us surprise you. Visit voiceamerica.tv today for sports, health, business, and more on demand 24/7.
How do you become one of the best companies to work for? By appreciating people for who they are and recognizing them for what they do. That's real recognition. 82% of employees say that recognition or praise they receive at work motivates them to improve their performance. And companies who recognize their people outperform companies that don't by 30 to 40%. Those are real results. Become one of the best companies to work for. The Recognition Management Institute can help you get the results you need. For more information, visit realrecognition.com. That's realrecognition.com.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Real Recognition Radio with Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown. This is what recognition is all about, getting real results in the workplace through meaningful recognition solutions. Now, let's get back to the program. Here are Roy and Max.
Welcome back to Real Recognition Radio. We're going to continue our conversation now with Sean Aker, our guest today, and just learn some final pointers on the happiness advantage. Sean, this has been an exciting conversation. I think we're seeing the great science behind your work that's truly proving that you need happiness first in order to get these productivity measures that companies are so looking for right now. But what are the next steps in positive psychology or even the research that you're doing in this area?
Well, the thing I'm most interested in right now is that information alone doesn't cause transformation. So you can give people at companies and people on your team ideas about how they should increase their levels of happiness, and here are the habits that we know can change your levels of happiness long-term and every one of these business outcomes. And then after giving all of that, many people don't make any changes. They don't change their habits. They don't change their mindset. So the real question is, how do we get over the barrier between information and transformation? And I spent an entire chapter in the Happiness Advantage talking about something called the 20-second rule, second like in seconds and minutes, the 20-second rule. What we found is that in order to make a change in a formula, and this is back from chemistry and physics in high school, there's an initial investment of energy called activation energy, which is at the beginning of the formula, and it's the highest amount of energy you have to put in throughout the whole formula to get that change to occur. Turns out the exact same thing is true for your brain and for a company as they try and catalyze the reaction in terms of creating positive change at a company or on a team. What we find is that there's an initial investment of energy called activation energy before you can start and make a change. But here's what we've been researching. We found that if you increase or decrease the activation energy slightly, your brain magnifies it for you, making it easier to start those positive habits and to tilt the path of least resistance away from negative habits. So what that means is, I'll give you two quick examples. Mm-hmm. One of those is if you have a negative habit. Like for me, after work I'd be tired, so I'd just sit down on the couch and I'd watch several hours of television. I'd watch, you know, on average 3 hours of TV at one point, which is still underneath the national average.
Average, yeah.
5.2 hours. But that was, I wasn't getting my work done. My productivity was lower. So what I did was I took the batteries out of the remote control, moved them 20 seconds away to my bedroom, put a 20-second barrier between me and the television. So the next couple of days when I come home, I press the on button on the remote control, realize the batteries are too far away, so I would turn towards other things that were easier to do. And I'd put a book out that I'd been wanting to read for years. I had work next to me on the couch. I had my phone so I could call my real friends instead of watching fake friends on TV. And as a result of that, I gained back 2 conscious hours a day on average by adding 20 seconds to my day. So what I did was I increased the activation energy for things that were negative. The flip works for positive habits. So what I'm hoping is after you've listened to the segment that we've been talking about, this research, or after you get a chance to read the book, that hopefully you'll make one positive change. And if you're going to, try to make it just slightly easier, about 20 seconds easier to start. So if you're going to exercise in the morning, put your athletic shoes right next to your bed. If you're going to start journaling, make sure you have a pen right on top of the journal, or put the journal document right on the desktop. Because what we found is if you make a positive habit just slightly easier, your brain will tilt the path of least resistance towards greater levels of happiness and success.
Wow. Certainly, that's. I'm going to see running shoes underneath my pillow tonight. I can just see it now. So, now, are there other ways that you can give as examples of what you do to stay positive in all that you have to go through in life?
Definitely. So, you know, I do all 5 of the habits that I mentioned every day. For me, those habits are gratitude, writing down 3 things I'm grateful for, journaling for 5 minutes a day, exercise, meditating. I meditate for about 15 to 30 minutes a day, but we suggest just starting with 2 minutes, and writing a kind email when I first open my inbox before I do anything. What I do is I use those positive habits over the course of my day as breaks, as cognitive breaks during my day. We find that if you work more than 90 minutes at a time, your brain actually loses accuracy and energy. So every 90 minutes or so in my work, I try and stop and take a break to do these habits. And they've become so much of a pattern, it doesn't feel like I'm adding anything more to my day. My day is just oriented around them. But as a result of that, I've been able to increase my levels of happiness. But what I suggest to people who are starting out on this is to just pick one habit. If you pick all 5 and try and do them all at one time, we find the adoption rate's very low. Pick one habit. Try and make it simple. So like one of the ones I tried doing was just playing guitar I wanted to play guitar every day. What I did was I made a little spreadsheet that I put on the wall, and it was just play 5 minutes of the guitar. Basically, I just had to pick up the guitar and strum it for a few minutes, and that counted. And that made my brain, that it's basically using that Zorro circle idea we talked about.
Right.
Made it easy enough to start. And as a result of that, if you walk around my house, you'll actually see that I've tilted the path of least resistance towards making things easier. My guitar is out of the case right next to the couch. I have a journal sitting right at my breakfast nook, so as soon as I'm eating breakfast, it's right there. The gratitudes are sitting right next to my bed. So as a result of that, all those things I'm doing at home, even before I get to work, are actually dramatically increasing my success rates once I get there.
Wow. Sean, I want to make sure our listeners have a chance to know how they can connect with you. What would be some best way to reach out, or URL, or where would you like people to reach you at?
Sure. The easiest way to read more about this research is to go to happinessadvantage.com. So the name of the book, and that has links to this research and links to free YouTube video clips that you could watch that describe this research in a little bit more detail.
Well, that's great. We want to make sure that people have that opportunity. And since you've written the book, it's been published, what stands out for you? What has been the most impact for you?
In terms of how...
As a result of what's happened from writing the book, maybe just what's happened since you've written it.
It's been incredible. The response, first of all, people seem to be really using these ideas to change not only their own lives, but their It was written originally for just helping people at work, but they're starting to realize this has impact for their home life or how they raise children or how they think about their own personal happiness as well. So I'm getting these fantastic emails from people who are sending me pictures of their desk that's entirely clean, or, you know, they just finished running a marathon, or they've been starting to do this with their child that they adopted, and all the successes they've been having. And as a result of that, what we're starting to realize is this research cuts across so many more domains than we realize. It's not just happiness at work. It turns out it's affecting every aspect of a person's life, because what it's changing is the lens through which your brain perceives the world.
Well, I think that's some very powerful insights. And in fact, as we've been going through this interview today, I've been certainly thinking about the family role, and was wondering, as you say, the kind of the impact that it must cross over the world, because happiness is about life, not just work, right?
You're right. We're seeing people start not only their board meetings with three things that they're grateful for, but starting their dinners as well when they get home. And my sister has a three-year-old child, and her little child, Christiana, when she is at the dinner table, she says what she's grateful for on the table. She points out everything, and she actually yells at you if you try and eat before she's finished saying all the things she's grateful for. So what they've done is they've created these patterns of scanning the world not just for the stresses and the negatives and the problems, but seeing the things that make us grateful for our lives, seeing the meaning that's inherent in our own work and in our personal lives. And as a result of that, not only changing our ability to be happier, but increasing our ability to do our work better and spreading that happiness to other people.
Well, Sean, I think you've brought some key insights to us all today on being able to know that we truly do matter, and that happiness is not just an outcome. It's how we should start the day. Thanks for being on the show today.
Well, thank you so much for having me and helping share this research with people.
Absolutely. Thank you, Sean.
Well, tune in to our next show, where Max and I will be continuing our discussion on digging deeper on building relationships, inspiring greatness, and creating workplaces where people can thrive. Max and I welcome and encourage your comments and suggestions. So continue to email us at feedback@realrecognition.com. We look forward to hearing from you. Thanks for listening to Real Recognition Radio. For more information about the Recognition Management Institute, you can visit us at realrecognition.com. Until next time, this is Roy Sonnison and Max Brown, reminding you to keep it real.
Thank you again for tuning in Real Recognition Radio. Please join Roy Sonnison and Max Brown again next Tuesday at 10 a.m. Pacific Time, 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel for more motivational tips to help your employees perform better. We'll talk again next week.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.